who is actually a independent. In fact, Robinson, who spoke out against the GOP in his autobiography for taking a hard turn towards racial tactics in the 60s. So, more of that that good conservatism. Never mind the facts. Don't worry about that. Just is what it is. A couple funny stories I came across that I want to talk about a second. A Utah man missed the birth of his child when he was arrested for groping a nurse outside the delivery room. This is one of those ones that you're just never going to get over.
Groping?
Groping.
That's a big thing.
That's
a big word.
That is a big word.
Specifically, what kind of groping?
Well, Adam Matting, 30, had rushed his partner to the hospital when she went into labor, but then police said Manning told a nurse wheeling the woman into the delivery room that she was cute, attempted to give her a neck massage, and finally grabbed her front. The nurse, of course, called police, and the police obviously arrested him, and obviously he missed the birth of his child. Kind of reminds me of one of the guys I worked with who solicited a prostitute down on 10th Street in Allentown the night his wife is giving birth. And just in case he's listening, John, prostitution is illegal.
Isn't that special?
That happened like 20 years ago, and the guy still hears about it, and good for him. Also, Ozzy Osbourne, the front man of Black Sabbath, he's 60 years old. He's finally passed his driving test after 18 attempts. Osbourne, 60, credits his reversal of fortune to having successfully given up drinking. The former Black Sabbath frontman says that on previous attempts, he would be walking around the test center with a bottle of vodka in my pocket, and that testing officials always seemed afraid to get in the car with him.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder if it's like smoking. They say if you quit smoking, as time goes on, your lungs get cleaner. Does that work with alcohol? Your brain cells are destroyed. Do they grow back, Rick?
I have no idea.
The poor guy, he can barely talk.
Oh, he's just a mess. But, I mean, he sings well. I mean, I like his music. He sings well.
Ozzy's a good entertainer.
Maybe he should just sing everything he wants to say. Because if you watch that show, anybody can understand the guy.
How do they get one of those reality shows? I mean, that's amazing.
No, it's all these reality shows. I mean, is there nothing on TV anymore but these crazy people? And the craziest people of all are the ones that are on. This one, evidently there's one with Lorenzo Lamas, who was like, an actor, semi-famous.
Mm-hmm.
His family's now on, and his wife's just crazy. And evidently, his son ended up cheating on his wife. Cheating on Lamas with his wife, and I'm going, is this what society has become? And this is where I do agree with some of the social conservatives. What's on TV is insane, which is why the Smith household doesn't have television. I've chose to turn it off. I'm not against it. You want to watch a train wreck of a TV show like that? You go right on ahead. You want to spend your life with American Idol and Cheetos? You go right on ahead. You have the right to do that. It's a free country. I just choose not to.
You know what used to amaze me when I was in the workplace? A lot of the women I work with, they just loved American Idol. And they talk ad nauseum about it. And I guess there's nothing wrong with that. But my point is, Rick, there's all kinds of important things happening in the national and international and that were relevant to their lives, but yet they're concentrating on, well, how did John sing? Or how did Mary perform? And I often wondered, it's not that the people I work with were any different. It's just a reflection of society, and it's kind of troubling.
It's not just kind of troubling. I mean, there are so many issues out there, like this one that I came across from the Associated Press. In Wichita, Kansas, the U.S. Army wants middle school students. That's right. The Wichita School District in South Central Kansas is one of the few nationwide offering middle school programs based on Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps curriculum. Top Army officials are studying its program to see if the model will work nationwide. So basically what they're saying is we're going to start offering ROTC programs to 8, 9, 10-year-old kids. And what's interesting about it is you listen to the Kansas Board of Education. One of the guys who's a member of the Kansas Board of Education, he says he plans to lobby Wichita's existing program to be selected as the Army's pilot program. And why is he going to do that? Because, quote, the Army The Army's got a lot deeper pockets than education. And, you know, my question when I read this, is this what we have, is this what's left? Have we given away all of our jobs? Have we ruined these kids' futures to the point to where there really isn't anything other than the military? And we better start training them at a young age. Because if we're going to continue to be this great war society, we're going to need more, we're going to need more warriors. And you might as well start young. Because, you know, we don't have pensions anymore. We don't have health care. We don't have the good, decent paying jobs that we've had in the past. So we better find something for our young people to do. And, you know, consider the fact that jobs are going overseas. The manufacturing capability of this country is now diminished. And, you know, for the low-wage worker, for the low-skilled worker, you know, maybe the military is the best way to go. And that's a sad testament to what this society has become.
Well, therefore, the truth was, during the height of the Iraq War, they were having real problems. But I think you're right. I think the economy, plus health care. I mean, whether you like Army life or you like military life, they provide you with 3 square meals. They provide you with a roof over their head, and they provide you with health care.
Well, I mean, it's even beyond that. Not only do they provide you with health care, they provide you with health care for life if you stay there long enough. They provide mm-hmm. you with a pension if you stay there long enough. The reality is that's what every job in this country should provide. If you put 30 years in with a company, you should get pension. You should get a health care. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's not looking that way. Another letter I wanted to get to, a letter to the editor written by a professor of political science at Villanova, which I found really interesting. It's under the title, Views on Afghanistan Build Up, Bring Clinton and Gates Together on an Alliance. He writes, I want to offer the Secretaries of State and Defense a warning that I came across in the papers of the late Senator Richard B. Russell, a Democrat from Georgia. After Senator Russell's one-time protege, President Lyndon B. Johnson, had moved the United States into a major war in Vietnam, something Senator Russell had warned against, he lamented in 1966 to a constituent in Georgia that opponents of the United States had outwitted us in getting us pinned down in the most unfavorable place in Asia to fight a war, unless it be Afghanistan. And you go now and you look at where we're tied down right now. And what this guy, this David Barrett, called the worst place on earth to fight a war. And as I've said before, Afghanistan is the graveyard of empire. We should know that from history. As I've said in the past, Bin Laden did more than Ronald Reagan did to bring the Russians down. 16 years they spent in Afghanistan.
Well, we helped the Mujahideen too. Well,
of course, that we helped. We funded Bin Laden. We created the monster. But the reality is, look, the current path, and we're going to talk about this tomorrow. The current path is unsustainable there. I am dead set against escalation. We need a change of tactic, and this is where I think Joe Biden needs to put his influence. My fear is that President Obama, who is a compromiser, is going to compromise on McChrystal's request. And instead of 40 or 60,000 troops being sent, we're going to see 20 or 30 sent. It's still an escalation. We're still ramping things up. And it's costing us millions and billions of dollars every year.
Well, the conservatives are framing it, if he doesn't allocate more troops, it gets into the security area. I think you and I agree on one thing. If you're going to help the country, it makes more sense to help them economically.
Yep, and you go back to the surge. You know, everyone said Bush had the great surge. The great surge was not what caused the turnaround. What caused the turnaround is those people who we took in took bags of cash and handed that money out to tribal leaders, saying, don't blow us up anymore. Gave them resources to build schools and hospitals and feed their people. And tomorrow we're going to talk about a guy's report who says, look, we need to pull out and we need to think a little bit differently. And we're going to talk about that tomorrow, along with who caused the debt. And, of course, we're going to be talking about the Citizens United case, which I think is the end of democracy if it goes the wrong way.
One last point on health care. The conservatives are saying the American people don't want it. Recent national survey, the percentage of people who supported public option went from 60% of the American people to 65% in one month. More and more and more, there's a consensus in this nation. We need a public option. We need health care reform. We need to force Congress
and
to go in that direction.
We will see you tomorrow.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those nails in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from a field.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Tune in every Saturday and Sunday from noon until 2 p.m. on WHYL AM 960. Or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Democracy is coming to the USA.
And now, a breaking news update from Rick Goodman.
In relationship to the issues that we voted Mr. Obama in to the presidency for, as of this hour, he is still irrelevant.
News from Rick's Place with Rick Goodner at Head On Radio Network, America's Liberal Voice. Tune in to Rick's Place at 7 p.m. on Saturday.
Something terrible is happening.
Something terrible is happening.
Something terrible is happening.
Something terrible is happening.
Health insurance executives are getting a bad rap.
As the healthcare debate heats up,
we need to remember who the real victims are.
Health insurance executives.
People are saying a lot of mean things about health insurance companies and their executives. And it's got to stop.
These great businessmen are American heroes.
So why is Obama trying to reform healthcare when insurance companies are doing just fine, making billions of dollars of profit?
Obama, why?
Insurance companies need our support because they keep our selfish priorities in check when we can't.
Please, doctor, my daughter's dying. She needs medication.
Think about somebody else for once.
If my kid falls off his bike and breaks his leg, he should have to pay that money out of pocket, out of his allowance.
How else is he going to learn not to fall off that bike?
And insurance companies are detail-oriented enough to deny claims for things like typos. If you spell something wrong, do you really deserve surgery? I don't think so.
80% of the American public support the public plan because it would give quality care people can actually afford.
But when you think about it, who's really supporting it other than 80% of the American people?
And the public option would make insurance companies lower their prices and give better service in order to compete.
What's so American about competition?
But health insurance companies are huge.
They need to make big profits so they can afford to give their employees health insurance.
Believe me, that stuff's not cheap.
It makes sense.
Insurance company CEOs have a right to their American dream.
And it's five houses.
A private plane.
$500 million in your pocket.
And a mini zoo in your backyard for exotic animals like a white tiger and pygmy horses.
Insurance companies offer you variety.
They can change the price and terms of your plan at any time or stop covering you altogether.
Do you want to get rid of those options?
So join us in the fight to protect our insurance company profits. They've looked out for our best interests for so long.
Now we should look out for theirs.
And I'm not being sarcastic, not at all.
MoveOn.org political action is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
Republicans want to end Medicare. You heard right. Republicans actually voted to abolish Medicare for future generations, one of the most important programs for seniors. America's seniors have relied on Medicare for over 40 years, and Democrats are working to strengthen Medicare. But the plain truth is, Republicans have opposed Medicare from the start. Their leaders have called for cutting Medicare, and now for killing it. The Republican Party, no friend of seniors. The Democratic National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Oh, there's no hurry. Tonight he'll be at Rick's. Everybody comes to Rick's.
I have already heard about this cafe and also about Mr. Rick himself.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine. What's that you're playing?
Oh, just a little something of my own.
Oh, stop it. You know what I want to hear.
No, I don't.
You played it for her, you play it for me.
Well, I don't think I can remember.
If she can stand it, I can. Play it.
Welcome to Rick's Place. We are open and ready. Here's the proprietor of Rick's and Horn's psychotherapist, Rick Goodner.
Hey there, little buckaroos. This is Rick Goodner, and you're here at Rick's Place at Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice, the Horn. We're going to do something quite different this time. Today, surprise, surprise, what a treat. No politics. Let's be honest. Politics has pretty much got everybody down. And I thought that I'll give you a treat. Maybe I can avoid a few tricks that way. What I have planned for you tonight is that we're all going to a Polidori party. Rick, what's a Polidori party? It's something that was started at the University of Dallas by a group of students there and some faculty. And it's something that I was introduced to along with the fine music of Leonard Cohen. And it really changed my life because it's probably the catalyst that got me to start writing. It's something like, here's exactly what it is. A group of people get together and they get to go to a party. There's fine food. Plenty of wine, beer, whatever anybody wants to bring to drink. But there's a difference. You have to pay to get into the party. And the price of admission? Whoa. You got to bring a short story. Now, this short story needs not be any longer than a double-spaced typed piece of paper. No more than 5 pages long. Quite easy, isn't it? Anybody can come up with a short story like that. It's not difficult at all. And when you get there, you can sit back and relax until it's your time to read. And then you get into the hot seat. You get to sit into the fine, the best chair in the entire house. sitting next to the crackling fire and candlelights all around you, and you read your short story, and everybody else is there, and they're transfixed, and they're transported to your world that you have created. Yes, everybody who writes is a creator. They're gods of their own. They choose what the characters do, what they don't do. It's really unique. So there we are. Sometimes it goes until 2, 3, 4 in the morning. Depends on how many people show up. And a lot of people always show up. Just look out there. We're having a Polidori tonight. And there's tens of you out there. And there's me and Mike here. This one's going to be a little bit different than any other Polidori, because I'm going to read to you some of my stories. And actually what I'm going to read to you is a part of my new book, The Polidori Party. And I want you to just sit back and enjoy and relax. And kind of think that one day you can be a part of the Polidori Party too. If you'd like, 5 pages, double-spaced, short story, send it to me. And next year I will read your story at our Polidori Party. Or who knows, maybe we'll pull together a real physical, not just a virtual Polidori Party, but a real one, where we can all get together and enjoy such a fine gathering, good friendship, great stories. One of the things that you're going to do tonight is something that we never allowed anybody else to do, which is you're going to be able to sit there and listen to stories, and you're not going to have to produce anything of your own. We had tons of people saying, I want to go, but I don't want to write a story, and I don't want to read. I just want to go in here. Well, no, sorry. No, everybody would like to do that. Uh-uh. This is your one and only chance, guys, to enter a Polidori Party where you don't have to read. Because the number one rule is, if you come, you must add to the party. And it is a delightful thing. Not this virtual one, of course, because there's no joking around. There's no getting a bit tipsy, because I do not believe in drinking and reading. So this will be a little bit different. That's just a little bit of history on the Polidori. But, Rick, there has to be more to it than that. Where do y'all come up with this? And what the hell is a Polidori? Who the hell is Polidori? That's the proper question. Now, long, long time ago, there was this gigantic rock star. Hundreds of years ago, there was this gigantic rock star. And an Undulan rock star. And his groupie. And there was a hanger-on. Maybe you might want to call him a roadie. These four people set off on a little summer adventure, and they went to Switzerland. But it was an extremely cold and damp summer. So they're pretty much locked into their chateau. Rock stars become very bored very fast. Now, this is a different kind of rock star from what you would think of today, but in all fact, they were the same thing as a rock star is today. You've heard of them. Well, most of them. There was Lord Byron, best poet, the number one guy, the one that all the girls swooned over, the rock star. Percy Shelley, he was there also. He was the second in line for the kingdom of the rock star. Kind of like a Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis thing. I had this little competition going all the time. That's what rock stars did. And along with Percy Shelley, oh, what a name, Percy. Anyway, he had his groupie. And then, of course, we had the roadie, And, you know, roadies, they kind of do work. They do. But this roadie was a doctor. His name was Dr. John Polidori. And like every roadie, he did his duty, I guess. To be honest with you, and I mean, I don't know for sure, but the literature seems to believe that he was the dope dealer for Shelley and Byron. He was a doctor, and he took care of their medical needs on this trip. Lord Byron, being the person he was, said, "Okay, I'm the best writer in the entire world, and I'm going to prove it to these people that are here." So he gets up and he says, "Okay, guys, it's boring, it's cold outside, we can't go walk, and there's nothing we can do. Let's have a contest. Let's see who can write the best ghost story. Ooh. And there will be a winner. We will pick from among us the one who writes the best ghost story." He really thought he had that one in the bag, and he may have, except for the groupie and roadie. They all put together their little stories. Then they read their stories, and Byron voted for himself. And he thought, "Okay, Shelley's groupie really wants me, not him, so she'll vote for me." He said this to herself, I guess. And you're going to have, the roadie, who wouldn't be anything, and he idolizes me, so he'll vote for me, so I'm going to win this one. I'm going to win this one. Shelley says, "Whew, I got this one beat. We know Byron's going to vote for himself, but I'm going to vote for myself. And I've got my groupie here. She'll vote for me, and now all I have to do is just win over the roadie, and I win this contest. This is pretty much a shoe-in. We've got it made. I am going to beat Lord Byron today. And I'm going to prove that I am the number one rock star. I am the king of rock and roll." Well, we don't know who won. We don't know how the voting went. Maybe each person voted for their own. Maybe the groupie won. Perhaps the roadie voted for just her, and she won. We don't know. Do you know what we do know, though, from history? We do know that whatever Lord Byron wrote disappeared, buried in history. No one has any idea what he put together. They just don't know. We do know that whatever Percy Shelley wrote disappeared in history as well. That's it. We don't know what they put together at that first Polidori. We have no idea at all. What we do know is that that roadie, Dr. John Polidori, wrote The Vampire. Spell with a Y. And it lives today. And it chills today, just like it did those hundreds of years ago. So you have a roadie that's outlasted Lord Byron and Percy at this one get-together. Do you see the beauty and the power of a Polidori party? How when you think that you can produce nothing that's worth listening to, it can turn out to be the best. And one that everybody talks about for years later. Oh, yeah, we do have the groupie thing, too. She did okay. She put together a little short story called, what was that? Oh, Frankenstein. Yes, that was the child bride, Mary Shelley. And at this Polidori party, she put together Frankenstein. Here we have the archetypes of evil and fear and horror brought together at this one party by the roadie and the groupie who no one has given any thought of before, and their works persevered. Now, that's enough history. I'm going to dabble into the book. I'm going to read a little bit of the introduction, and then give you a few short stories. I hope y'all enjoy this as much as I've enjoyed writing them. I hope that when the Polidori actually hits the bookshelves, that you'll give them a try. You may enjoy them. And don't forget, Codependent Waterbore, Amazon.com's a publisher. Check that out. Funny. Good work. And The Fox Syndrome, Right-Wing Media-Induced Shared Psychotic Disorder. You can get those today. Fine work from a fine artist. Here we go. Here we begin. Here we trace through time and space and look into my dark brain at this Polidori party. Chapter 1, The Polidori Party, Imitation. The Rolodex completed its spin. The third card under Mac was selected, and the right number are punched into the keypad. However, does he really want to make such a silly call? Too late to hang up now. McQueen residence. Hi, Sherry. This is Matt Ryder. Is your mom in? How's it going, Mr. Ryder? Are you getting used to all that Texas heat down there? Then you said it was hot enough to melt the paint off of my car. Well, kiddo, you never get used to the heat here, but you learn fast how to survive it. Now, with the paint gone, you don't have to wash your car as often. That doesn't sound too bad. Hold on, Mr. Ryder. I'll get Mom. Thanks, honey. Reopening the letter he had in his hand, Matt reads for the sixth time. John Polidori cordially invites you to a night of good food, remarkable libations, and great storytelling. All arrangements have been made in your name for air passage and accommodations. This year's story theme is time. RSVP not required. Matt fans out the airplane boarding pass and the hotel reservation reading. Dallas-Fort Worth to Austin Erstrom, October the 30th. Driscoll Hotel, room 214, October the 30th through November the 1st. Austin Erstrom to Dallas-Fort Worth, November the 1st. He is really sure that I will be free for his little get-together in 2 months. Is he not? Hey, Maddie, how in the hell is the old Dallas Morning News getting along with their new crack political reporter? What can I say, Stephanie? The backbone of any newspaper is politics, sex, and maybe a dead body from time to time. I give them a story with all three, along with the top Republican leaders in the state. Now they think I walk on water. Well, keep your feet dry. Got to. So what's up? No, I will not send you my air conditioner. What is it there now? 115? Nope. Damper down to 04 at noon today. Christ. I don't miss that at all. Will you be saying that in December when it's 20 below up there? Hell no. I'll be visiting you. We'll see. Look, the reason I'm calling is I got an invite from your old pal, Polidori, to come to one of his fiestas. I remember that you went to one of those a year or so back. And I was just wanting to find out what kind of stories I should bring. You know, maybe get some advice from one who has sat at the foot of a god. My advice? Don't go. Is the food that bad? No, but what he calls his ambrosia will kill you. Stephanie sounded much too serious for Matt's taste. And more so, as she continued with, not all of you, but too much of you. Oh, righty then, Matt said without knowing what to say. Listen, you know I've had a drug and drinking problem some years back. Yep, you took the AA cure and quit everything, if I remember right. AA? Hell no. I wanted to get clean, not become a member of a fundamentalist religious cult. I went to a therapist and we worked through the recovery real fast. And what's best about it is that I didn't have to stay in the recovery room for the rest of my life. I got over the drugs. Anyway, I stopped drinking and everything. Christ, I hit rock bottom. I had to. Stephanie pauses and then continues with, I received his invitation last year, plane tickets, hotel reservation, everything that I'm sure that you have received. Acknowledged. I've always been aware of Polidori's parties. Only the cream of the cream of the literary community is ever invited. So I was damn happy to get my invitation. Everything was great. October in Texas is paradise. The Driscoll is the greatest hotel in Austin. What history those walls have witnessed. And I even had time to ramble over to the house where O. Henry put his pen to paper to give life to the many of his short stories. All in all, there was no reason not to be happy to be at Polidori's party. Even Polidori, though a bit singular, was a great host. Moreover, being in the presence of the other writers was quite an honor. Polidori's ambrosia, as he called it, was the problem. He picked me first to read, based on the Keefe rule. The Keefe rule? Matt inquired. Keefe Hayes, the great humorist and political satirist, at one of Polidori's parties, is said to have demanded the right to read first. When asked by one of the other partygoers, by which right does he demand to read first? He said, because I had the biggest dick. I being the fair maid that I am, I imagined it was Polidori's attempt at a joke. Anyway, Polidori picked me to read first and took out of the locked sideboard a gold inlaid glass decanter of his ambrosia, from which he attempted to fill my wine glass. I placed my hand over the flute, begging his pardon, explaining that I am off the sauce. Undeterred, he insisted that I at least taste the infusion, which is most extraordinary and of which I will never have an opportunity to ever come into contact with again in my lifetime. So you tried his cocktail? No. Not that much. But yet too much. I was not going to go back on my word to myself to make that old fart happy. So I put my wine glass up to my lips in such a way that no one could see that I did not take a drink. Save for Polidori, who saw or at least knew. Because before I was able to lower the wine glass back down to the table, Polidori was at my side, insisting that I at least wet my tongue. For I cannot miss this opportunity. I put the glass back up to my lips and the wine made contact with my lips. Merely that. Nothing more. Polidori was satisfied. He turned to the others at the table and said, to the teller of the tale. And I was toasted by one and by all as I started to undergo the highest rush I have ever had. No cocaine, no speed has ever given me such a rush. I was able to see everything at once, hear everything at once, feel everything at once. I knew everything at once. I was the universe. All others were planets about me. Polidori took his seat, opened that damn black book of his, and requested me to tell my story. My eyes fixed upon the book, which now appeared to be trimmed in fine gold. I told. No, I did not just tell my story. I lived my story. I was in the story. No, I was the story. Also, when each in attendance told their story, I was there, standing back, nevertheless, there, watching the stories as they unfolded. It was the most intense experience I have ever had. Sounds cool. Cool. Better said as code. Matt, that son bitch took something from me. I don't know what it is that he took, but I know he has it. I'm not the same. I feel it's lost. He sucked something out of me. You mean like a vampire? That. Perhaps. Only not blood. Despite the fact that I wished it was, I think he took a part of my soul. Oh. Okay. Right. Look, Matt, I know what you're thinking. In your place, I would too. Nevertheless, it's true. You go there, and you will leave less than you are. Perhaps I will go there. I have not made up my mind yet. Think hard on it. And then stay home. But I know you. You'll go. If you must, then for the love of God, don't touch that cursed ambrosia of his. Well, I'm not sure that I'm going anyway. I could be assigned anywhere by October. But if I do go, I will not drink the wine. Stephanie, thanks for the info. I'm going to have to get back to work. Got deadlines coming up. Okay, Matt. Just you think about what I told you. Will do. Talk to you later, sweetie. Later, Shug. Replacing the receiver, Mike thanks. So, that's what it is like to have one's brain flooded by drugs. No, I think she must have got that way after she stopped the drugs. There must be a lesson in there somewhere. Stephanie McQueen, America's First Lady of Hobgoblins. Girl, you had better start writing children's books and get out of the horror business. You are beginning to believe you are living your stories. Fat Buckaroos was the first few paragraphs of the intro into Polidori Party. And go a few pages in, and now we're starting on one of my short stories that's added into it. This one here is called A Time to Kill. And loving the tropics, which by the time that you're reading this, I'll be more than prepared to head off to my tropical paradise for vacation. And which reminds me, you are going to have a Worst of Ricks next week. I hope it isn't too bad, and I hope that you enjoy it. And when I come back, I will give you some new material. We'll have a new things to talk about. But for now, A Time to Kill. There are ways of seeing the world that our eyes do not allow for. The eyes can blind us, keeping us earthbound. Allow me to demonstrate. Close your eyes. Close them. Good. Now, let your mind lift you and send you to the faraway lands. Let it give you the ability to hear the innermost thoughts, fears, dreams of those you observe. Sail with me past Land's End, across water, passing ships plowing their way towards what? To love, to mystery, to misery, to hell, or others' travails. No matter, that ship is past. Our destination is there, that light in this oceanic night, which glows into the island. Now down to the balcony of the hotel. It's okay. We can walk through. But the occupants can't see, hear, or even sense us. There's Tom, staring at the patterns on the wall, which are reflected from the bay below. Now listen. Now with your ears, with your mind, and you would drift into the dark caverns, Tom's human and malicious essence. All this time, and now it's here. The bitch will meet her maker tomorrow. And I, the poor, bereaved husband, will reap the benefits. The money is nice. But to be rid of this Dalton slut will be my real reward. And no one will ever suspect her devoted husband. If I was going to do her in, why would I wait 2 years after buying the insurance policy? Why would I have put the biggest policy on myself? And why would I be so heartbroken? They say there's no perfect crime. Of course there is. It just takes time to kill. And now is the time. Tomorrow, as we dive, I will get this whore away from the others, and I will simply turn off her air, hold her down, watch her drown. Then, turn back on the air. I must remember to turn back on the air. This is no time for a dumb fuck-up. Then, I will let her float. Now move back, release your grip, and drift to the starry-eyed one lying next to him. This should be a little more pleasant. As you can see, Isabel, also is staring blankly, but on her face is a hint of a smile, for her thoughts drift deeply, passionately, to the event of the day before. For she lives and relives every part of the day's event, a day like none other in her life. How do these things happen? Really? There's no way to tell. Although I'm convinced there are no accidents in life. What started out as an afternoon walk turned into the most eventful phase of Isabel's life. Like so many things that a person experiences, which gives the most joy in their life, this also unfolded at the directions of an unseen, unfelt, unlooked for hand. I won't bore you with the full progression. Let it do for me to say that the dance of the thorn between Isabel and one of the inhabitants of this beautiful Caribbean island, Roberto. After their meeting, they spent the afternoon walking and keeping each other within their lonely company. Isabel was not really aware of the feelings that she was assembling, nor was she much surprised when that small flame inside her burst into napalm and put her mind-numbing life on a pyre. First, an innocent brush. Then, with progression of time's fingers touched, hands felt out each other, desire fused. The real events of the day took place as Roberto and Isabel were walking out of one of the island shops. Without communicating their desire to do so, they walked straight across the street onto the beach. With shoes removed, they walked with their feet in the cold water. Long walks, discreet talks, life without clocks. Eventually, the subject was approached. As to Isabel's marital status, she stopped, eyes out to the sea. She picked up a small stone from the beach as the water gently kissed her toes. She rolled the stone around in the palm and slowly allowed it to roll from her hand back to the beach. As Isabel played this scene repeatedly in her mind, she stepped over the mundane responses that must have rejoined Roberto's question. Instead, as she remembered, she turned to him, placed her hand on his shoulders, and slowly slides it to the back of his neck and pulls him down to her lips. Now, a kiss is just a kiss, so says the song. But there is more than one kiss, and this one was more. Roberto pulls back slightly from Isabel and gives her lower lip a slight bite. More time passes as the walk continues until, in the evening, a light shower moves from the sea and bathes the two lovers. With little care given to the drizzle, they walked on to stand beneath one of the many palm trees on this now deserted beach. Isabel leans back against the wet tree. Roberto leans in close to her, encircling arms. Long moments pass. Time departs. The rain rains. Isabel can't remember how it happened, but her shirt was open, and her small, perfect breasts were exposed. The rain soaks Elizabeth's hair and runs in small streamlets down her face, into her eyes, making rain tears that travel down her face, her neck, her breast, to redeposit into droplets just beneath the nipple. Roberto leans forward and kisses the drop away. He pulls back, looks deeply in Isabel's eyes, lost. Roberto's wet hand slides down her back, then around to Isabel's flat stomach, then up, slowly, pressing each thumb over each rib in turn as the rain drops through the leaves of their unsheltering shelter. Roberto steps back a bit further, takes Isabel's hand in his, and walks backwards into the sea as the rain camouflages their footprints. They enter the water waist-deep. Roberto, one at a time, kisses Isabel's eyes closed. Love is made. Is she his thunder on the bay? Is he her rain at twilight? Are they the mist rolling past the hills? Is this a dream to stay? The scenario has played through Isabel's sleepless night. However, now the sun is showing its face. Isabel slides out of bed and ambles towards the bathroom. She stops at the mirror, gazing at her nude body, and gives a small cry of disgust and walks on. By the way, you do know that mirrors don't like women. It's true. Every time a woman looks into a mirror, even though she may be gorgeous, she is never satisfied with what she sees. Conversely, mirrors love men, for it matters not how they look. The mirror expresses itself much more positively. Case in point, Tom, he gets out of bed, walks over to the mirror, sucks in 5 inches of fat around his middle and says, "Ha, couple more push-ups and we're talking major studum here." Tom walks on. They share a fast boat ride with 9 other divers, a dive master and his assistant. As the boat pulls out from the bay, Isabel hands Tom his caplet that he takes for his high blood pressure. Then, only then, does Tom realize that for the first time in 7 years, Isabel had forgot to give him his medicine at breakfast. No big deal. She will never forget again. She then hands him 2 Valium. This was unusual, for Tom habitually took only 1 a day. Once again, no big deal, thinks Tom. This dumb bitch is making my chore easier, for now I will be more relaxed to do my duty. Isabel says, "Chew on her, Johnny. Anyway, you'll be more relaxed and won't use as much air as you normally do." Tom nods and takes the 2 Valiums. Unlike the slow dive boats, the fast dive boats makes it a short trip to the edge of the reef. In no time at all, divers are in the water and exploring the already explored to their heart's content. Tom was just running through his mind a plan of to lure Isabel over to the edge of the reef for when, away from the others, he could put his plan into action. But to his surprise, Isabel points to a V over the edge of the reef and indicates with her hands that she would like to go there. Tom, his mind a little unfocused, thinks, "This is easier than I could have ever hoped for." Isabel and Tom swim to the V in the reef as the other divers swim off to their destination. Tom is amazed at his lack of excitement over what he is about to do. "Valiums are working," he thinks. In reality, he's feeling very relaxed and starts to spend more time in the dive than he would have planned. Thoughts begin to come slower, and he's very, very relaxed. Isabel,
all this time is watching Tom intensely, watching him as he laid flat in the water and floated over the edge of the reef. He turns and heads back towards Isabel. His movements are slow. Isabel watches. 30 minutes after taking two Valiums, and Isabel can hear Tom snoring in his regulator. He's asleep. Isabel swims over to Tom, raises his purge valve, and releases the air out of his buoyancy compensator. Tom floats gently over the edge of the reef and descends into the cobalt blue, which gives way to 3,000-foot drop to the bottom of the sea. Now, my gentle listeners, allow your mind to
explore
once more as Isabel thinks. It's amazing how many crushed Valiums I was able to get into that capsule. Well, buckaroos, seeing how it's Halloween-ish, now we'll liven it up a little with the tale of the end of time. Mr. Little, C. Little, to be exact, for he always went by his first initial and his last name, placed his hand on top of the slagmite and pulled with his full strength to no avail. He fell back onto the limestone floor of his sanctuary, his salvation, and his prison. The pounding had been going on for 53 days now, and it had been a long time since C. Little had any food. There was water, yes, water that tasted of minerals, but it was water all the same. It all started on that fateful day. It started out as an ordinary day for Mr. C. Little. Just an ordinary day, one like all the others in C. Little's ordinary life. The alarm sounded at 5:30. C. Little rolled out of bed, onto the floor, onto his knees, and into the bathroom. Just an ordinary day and an ordinary ride on an ordinary road to his ordinary job. Nothing in C. Little's life has ever been anything but ordinary until that day. Until that day, C. Little lived his life by one philosophy only, that being, in all things, mediocrity. Early to bed, early to rise, C. Little was neither healthy, wealthy, nor wise. So he drove on towards his date with the extraordinary. There was a flash, a bang, and the road in front of him was vaporized into dust. There was nothing else to do but to pull off to the side of the road and watch as the cars that were behind him passed to disappear into the dust and surely into the eternity. It really did not matter, for that was only the beginning. Soon the earth was being pounded by 2, then 7, then 34, then hundreds of meteorites. From his vantage point within the confines of the Hyundai, just an ordinary Hyundai, the meteors could be seen screaming their path of fire across the smoke-tinged sky, racing headlong towards their terrestrial population. What was C. Little to do? He could not go forward. There was no road in the back of him where the bombardment appears to be the heaviest. For that reason, he turned the wheel and raced across the desert sands. He drove for at least a half an hour, dodging craters and dust geysers without any idea of where he would go or a safety could be found. The pounding had intensified, and very little of the sky could be seen now, for the disintegrating earth was rapidly taking up residence within the upper atmosphere, and thousands upon thousands of flaming rocks have completely removed all the blue from up there. However, luck was with him that day. This is if you believe in the concept of luck. The Hyundai banged into a steel post that supported a fence put up by the state park personnel to protect the entrance to the cavern. Instantly ascertaining that his salvation was less than 40 yards to his left, C. Little ran from his car, pushing aside women, children, pot-bellied, skinny-legged, bald-headed, cursed, middle-aged men as he ran past the turnstiles into the safety of the cavern. He ran fast and deep past the ropes that kept the summer vacationers
within the confines of the explored. He ran until the pain slowed him to a walk. Pain, not only from his lungs and legs that protested the unaccustomed exertion, but also from his collision with the limestone ramparts that he could no longer see due to the darkness that has closed in about him. After he passed the lighted area, there are no lights this far down into the unexplored parts of the cave. And here, in the dark Lapras, is where he had been all of this time, first walking, then crawling, now mostly just lying with his arms locked around and his face pressed against the cold stone breast of one stalagmite or another. The pounding is becoming harder to hear now, and he thinks of what little thought he could put together, that soon it would be over. If C. Little could see the light coming his way, it would do him no good. If C. Little could truly hear the footsteps coming his way, it would do no good. For his eyes and ears have betrayed him for the last 53 days. There were no meteors. No need to run. No need to hide. What caused a person's mind to become the betrayer, to create sights and sounds that could never exist, at least not on this plane, and then kill the very organism that sustains it? Perhaps the answer is best explored as a question put by my friend, my poet extraordinaire, Maggie Landrum. Those who hear voices, what do they say? Where might they come from? Will they ever go away? If you hear voices, what will they say? Will you tell anyone? Will you hope they go away? Those who hear voices, do they respond in some way? Will some take drugs? Will others hope and pray? If you hear voices, what will people say? Will they call you crazy? Will all your friends go away? Those who hear voices, do your neurons go astray? Is it your unconscious? Does it matter anyway? If you hear voices, do they get in your way? Do you know a new dimension? Will they ever go away? The lights of Sea Little's would-be rescuers are closer now. They dance across his face as the light that is his life flickers and then extinguishes. Well, I guess we'll go ahead and take a break now. I really hope that I was able to weave a nice little spell for you. I love it when I put a spell on you.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
You're listening to Rick's Place on the Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice. Hang in there, Rangers. We're fixing to be right back.
Hi, boys and girls. This is Rick Goodner, part of the Weekend Wrecking Crew. And I'm here to tell you that you cannot miss Billy Shears. The man knows his music. The man knows what you're thinking. Tune in and listen. You'll be surprised. He's going to play the very song that you were thinking that you needed to hear. He's a genius. Maybe a bit psychic. I promise you. Tune in on the weekend, listen to Billy Shears Night Sounds, and you will hear the song you've been waiting to hear. And you'll enjoy your time as much as I do. Right here on the Horn Head On Radio Network. Make sure you don't miss what you've been waiting to hear.
I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Play, Sam. Play as time goes by.
Breaking news update from Rick Goodner.
In relationship to the issues that we voted Mr. Obama into the presidency for, as of this hour, he is still irrelevant.
From Rick's Place with Rick Goodner at Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice. Tune in to Rick's Place at 7 p.m. on Saturday.
Something terrible is happening.
Something terrible is happening.
Something terrible is happening.
Something terrible is happening.
Health insurance executives are getting a bad rap.
As the healthcare debate heats up,
we need to remember who the real victims are.
Health insurance executives.
People are saying a lot of mean things about health insurance companies and their executives. And it's got to stop.
These great businessmen are American heroes.
So why is Obama trying to reform health care when insurance companies are doing just fine, making billions of dollars of profit?
Obama, why?
Insurance companies need our support because they keep our selfish priorities in check when we can't.
Please, doctor, my daughter's dying. She needs medication.
Think about somebody else for once.
If my kid falls off his bike and breaks his leg, he should have to pay that money out of pocket, out of his allowance.
How else is he going to learn not to fall off that bike?
And insurance companies are detail-oriented enough to deny claims for things like typos. If you spell something wrong, do you really deserve surgery? I don't think so.
80% of the American public support the public plan because it would give quality care people can actually afford.
But when you think about it, who's really supporting it other than 80% of the American people?
And the public option would make insurance companies lower their prices and give better service in order to compete.
What's so American about competition?
But health insurance companies are huge.
They need to make big profits so they can afford to give their employees health insurance.
Believe me, that stuff's not cheap.
It makes sense.
Insurance company CEOs have a right to their American dream.
And it's 5 houses.
A private plane.
$500 million in your pocket.
And a mini zoo in your backyard for exotic animals like a white tiger and pygmy horses?
Insurance companies offer you variety.
They can change the price and terms of your plan at any time or stop covering you altogether.
Do you want to get rid of those options?
So join us in the fight to protect our insurance company profits. They've looked out for our best interests for so long.
Now we should look out for theirs.
And I'm not being sarcastic, not at all.
MoveOn.org political action is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
Republicans want to end Medicare. You heard right. Republicans actually voted to abolish Medicare for future generations, one of the most important programs for seniors. America's seniors have relied on Medicare for over 40 years, and Democrats are working to strengthen Medicare. But the plain truth is, Republicans have opposed Medicare from the start. Their leaders have called for cutting Medicare, and now for killing it. The Republican Party, no friend of seniors. The Democratic National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Welcome back, Rangers, to Rick's Place. Now here's the number one Ranger, the proprietor of Rick's and Horn's psychotherapist, Rick Goodner.
Welcome back, Rangers. This is hour two of Rick's Place, a special edition of Halloween Stories. The Polidori Party is continuing. Rick's Place, Head On Radio Network, America's Liberal Voice. Don't forget to make your contributions. This is listener-supported radio. I hope you have enjoyed so far my little ditties, and I'm going to continue now. We're going to dive back in and get a few of these done. This next one was really a challenge. I was challenged by some of the members of the Polidori Society that for the next party, they wanted to know if I could do something that had some romance in it. I've never really done that. And so they thought, well, actually, I was accused of, you know, Rick, you're completely unromantic. So here it is. I'm going to prove to them and you that I can be very romantic. Here we go. A quarter to four. It was a dark and stormy night. Somewhere, but not here at the top level of the number nine of the parking garage. The sun is clear October with only an occasional cloud to scud past the full moon that illuminates the nights with its pale brilliance. Jesse found himself here often over the past few months. Separately, he loved the night and high places. Together, they cleared his head and seduced his roller coaster into a more level plane. Therefore, it was here, at this time of the night, that he was able to find the peace that forsaked him throughout the day. Standing at a low retaining wall, Jesse faced in the direction from which the sun would soon ascend. He permits his eyes to meander slowly from one distant light to another with vague questions as to why. Why would they be on at a quarter to four? Some people getting up, shaking sleep off to go to work. Others unable to sleep. Perhaps some making love. No, not with the lights on. That most wonderful emotional release is kept for the dark, and in many cases with little sound as possible. Sad but true. Now, the light is saved for the other side of love, rage, anger, and drunken cruelty. That's all that is allowed to grow in the light. He sees, hears, feels, or in some other way discerns that he's no longer alone. Without turning, he speaks. You don't have to stand in the shadows. Come into the moonlight. I've been waiting for you. The night's been so long, and I've been so alone. With a turn of his head, he adds, God, you're beautiful. I need you so much. You know, I've been told that before. You're going to love me for the rest of my life. But I always seem to have more life left than I do love. I hope you are telling me the truth. And this time, I will be loved for the rest of my life. Come to me. But first. There's always a but first with you. I know. I did promise. It's just that it's not easy. You come upon me like a vampire lover, sucking every emotion out of me. Thank God I only have three more to tell you about. It would have only been two if not for a party 2 weeks ago. Well, let's get this freak show over on the road. Where did I leave off? Wendy. Yes, Wendy. Okay. We have been madly in lust for years. She's my best friend. Tackle the song, we're best friends with benefits. When we go out and we do not meet anyone, we never have to go home alone. We're so attuned that even miles apart, we know when we are thinking about each other. We like the same things, the same drink, the same sports. We have the same taste in food. Hell, we even have the same taste in women. And therein lies the dilemma. If not for this one little article, ours would be a perfect relationship. For although Wendy is always there for me, she will never be completely for me. How does a man compete with a woman for the heart of another woman? It's hopeless. Moving on. And then there's Stacy. She's the most difficult to talk about. Just to think of her opens a hole in the middle of me that's impossible to feel. It's an emptiness that burns and consumes relentlessly, without end, without relief. I cherish Stacy more than I would have believed possible. That's the long and the short of it. Love unrealized, unfulfilled, unrequited. You remind me so much of her. The way you stand there next to the wall. A few short months ago, she stood there at the same place. With the midnight breeze inducing her hair to caress her face in the same way. We talked long that night. As time took a respite. Talk comes so easy with her. She understands so much. Yet everything is new and a puzzle to be solved. We know more about each other than anyone will ever know of us. We have opened our dark chasms to each other and have accepted what we have unearthed. Love me? Does she? I know she does. I can read it in her face. Not that she could ever acknowledge it. Not even to herself, because she's also in love with an ideal. An idea that is fixed in a constellation with all of its false securities that it has to offer. I'm a wanderer, a planet moving from one constant star to another. No security there. But so is Stacy. That's what scares her the most. For when planets collide, the foundations of the universe quiver. She wants nothing more than to be securely fastened to a predictable, constant existence. She's afraid of that internal tug that has been pulling her all of her life. She fears becoming lost if she answers the call. But the truth is, she would find herself and for once stop living as a projection of others. No, I can't. It would be too painful to her if I was to push it. This is something she must struggle through on her own. I'd never put her through such travail. That is all I'm going to say about Stacy. Anyway, the night is waning towards morning. There's one more to go. About 2 weeks ago, I went to a party. Utterly unusual, for normally I avoid them like pestilence. This one unfolded like all the others. A group of people working hard to show how good of a time that they were having. I drifted in. I was about to drift out when I was approached by a cherub with brown eyes who appeared to be as ill at ease as I was. Well, to get to the heart of the matter, we spent a delightful time together that ended only with the rising of the sun. What became of it? She sobered up. Jesse spits over the wall. Something I planned never to do. Okay, I kept my part of the bargain. I expose myself to you now. You are going to keep yours, aren't you? Are you going to love me for the rest of my life? Are you? He turns slowly. You say I should come to you? Although I want to more than I can imagine, I shudder at taking that step. I should come to you? Steps closer to the edge. Then give me your hand. You will love me for the rest of my life. I know I need to come to you, but first, the nightmares will end. I will come to you. You will love me, will you not? Good. God, you feel so good, so warm, so alive, so... It was a dark and stormy morning, somewhere but not here next to the foundation of the parking garage. The sky is clear October with only an occasional cloud to scud past the rising sun as it illuminates the scarlet riverettes drip, drip, dripping from the corners of Jesse's mouth, revealing that with just a hint of a smile, he was loved too. Okay, see? There it is. There's the proof. There is no doubt whatsoever in the world. Rick Goodner is a hopeless romantic. Isn't that something? Doesn't it warm your heart? Well, let's see if I can warm your heart up a little bit more. We're going to take a little time to choose. What will it be, human? Asked a creature standing in the mist. The creature could be called a creature not due to some hideous appearance, but solely because it was not human. What be, is the human's response. Door number one, door number two, or door number three, answered the creature in a voice that could have rivaled the game show host, as it indicated that the human should look to the right. There, standing in the mist, without support, without walls, without cause, was three doors. The human turned back to the creature and asked, where am I and how did I get here? A choice, and by 38. 38? The hell is 38? Smith and Wesson, I think. Yes, Jeff Smith and Wesson, 38, returned the creature. The human only blinked and stared at the creature until it volunteered. You were going to lunch in your car, turned out of the parking lot into the alley next to your office, a young male human, I think, 14, yes, 14 years old, was climbing over the fence that separated the alley from the warehouse. He had the face of an angel, which, by the way, was his name, and the heart of 1,000 demons. And a 38 Smith & Wesson, definitely a 38 Smith & Wesson. As he stepped to the ground, your eyes met. He raised the 38, put a deep little hole in your windshield, as well as your forehead. Of course, the hole in the back of your head was not so neat. Now, as to where you are, you're at a choice. Now you must choose. What will it be? Door number one, door number two, or door number three? The human, not at all shocked by the story of the creature had just told. Somehow, it knew it already. The pressing question now voiced is, what are the doors? Creature moved towards the door and said, door number three. I don't know. Maybe a step forward, perhaps a step back. I can't tell. I've never been able to see behind the door. Door number one and two are re-entries to your own life. Revised somewhat, of course. Door number one will let you live over your life's happiest moments. When all your choices were right, when everything you did worked the way it was planned. Of course, you must understand that those times were few and far between, so the time you will have will be very short. Short it will be, also intense and happy, but short. You have known humans who have walked through that door. They seem to live a charmed life. Everything they do is right, and everything goes their way. Always happy, with a bright future ahead of them. Then, bang, they're dead. Just like that, gone in a flash. Door number one is great, but short. Step through door number two, and you'll have a long life. It's long because you will relive all the mistakes, and you cannot change a thing. You will relive all your mistakes just as the first time. Nevertheless, it will be long, long, a very long life. Moreover, as before in your life, human, you have known people who have walked through that door. Therefore, I don't need to tell you much about this door. You need to tell me, human, will it be door number one door number two or door number three? What will it be? One, two, three, tell me. The human looked at door number one and thinks, oh God, to live over all those happy times, short, intense, but short. Door number two, I will have most of my life to relive. I don't know. To relive all my mistakes, it would be long years, many faults. Then again, it was not that bad, was it? There is door number three. What lies in the mist, through the mist, beyond the mist? Step back, step forward. The great unknown, the great unsolved, the great Tell me, human, it's time to choose. What will it be? Door number one, door number two, or door number three? The human looks over at the creature, gives a wink, turns, and walks towards the chosen. This next story, I really formulated it when I was a small kid. We were driving in a hot August, going towards Dallas from Wichita Falls, and I looked over to the side, and there was this most delightful lady sitting under a tree selling watermelons. And my mind just kind of went, whoa, and went off into Rickland. And some many years later, I remembered that little thought, and it came back to me, and I sat down and in about 20 minutes penned this. Well, for your pleasure, time and time again. The leaves sacrificed themselves to the blazing July sun for her benefit. They wilt in the day star, but in so doing, they shade her gray hair. This is her place of business and has been for 40 years. She sets up shop here every day at 10, after all the chores are done and Matt's deeds have been seen to. One would think that under the branches of this August oak tree would be a strange place for commerce. But when one lives on the outskirts of Henrietta, a place of limited opportunities, this side affords the most advantage location. Here, on two lanes of Interstate 287, is the customer base. Under this stately oak is the shop, and the produce gleaned from Sarah's garden is the merchandise. Sarah inherited this location from her grandmother, who sold the same goods to travelers since 287 was just a one-lane road that conveyed Model T's. However, that was well before Sarah's time. By the time that Sarah was a child of five playing at the base of the, even then, old oak, her grandmother sowed her harvest to soldiers on their way to Camp Bowie to wait there for their embarkation to the European theater in World War II. Sarah spent her summers keeping her Nana company until she married and then became a full partner in this enterprise. Sarah mops the beads of sweat from her face with an apron and looks east down the empty two-lane. Business has not been good today. Only four cars stopped so far. And it was well into afternoon. Nevertheless, there is money. Money. Oh, sure. One can call $4.37 lying in the tattered White Owl cigar box money, but tomorrow may be better. Tomorrow. There's always a tomorrow, right? Sarah looks down and kicks some of the red dirt sand at a red ant to keep it at bay. Then she observes her legs, now four times the size that they were when she was first married, and thinks how thin she once had been. The same legs that now are more pain than not. At one time could support her through a long night of dancing. And how she did love to dance. She remembered how she could have two-stepped all across Texas if she had so wished. Dance, dance, dance. That's what sealed Matt's fate. It was the Pioneer Days dance that Sarah first met Matt, who was new to town, a transplant from Petrolia, He was uneasy in the unfamiliar surroundings of the street dance. Now, a word here about street dances. A street dance is a uniquely small Texas town event. For only in such a location can the main street of the town be blocked to automobile traffic to allow for the transformation into an open-air dance hall. And there on Main in Henrietta, under the stars, Sarah, on a dare from her friends, approached Matt and without a word took his hand and walked him to the edge of the street, waiting for Matt, who waited for the right beat. Then they moved together and danced. As I said before, Matt's fate was sealed that night. To put it straightforward, Matt could dance. And Sarah melted into his body, embraced, and their movements became a flow. They flowed into each other's arms and hearts so long ago, so many tears, so many years. At 16, Sarah married Matt, who had just turned 18. There had been many hard times, many bad days. Overall, for the most part, it has been good. Matt is a good man. And a good farmer of their small holdings. Even through bad times, there's always been a roof over Sarah's head and food on the table. Matt, even in those late years, worked hard. Well, he did before. Yes, before the headaches started, before the falling down, before the blackouts. Sarah thinks cancer. What in the hell does that horse doctor know? I need to run Matt over to Wichita Falls and see a real doctor who can look him over. Hell, I bet it's just migraine. I can't eat either when I get a migraine. Yep, I bet that's what it is. Just a real bad migraine. Sarah looks down at the ground and finds a shadow. She traces it back to the trunk of the oak and slides her eyes up to the branch. She notices the position of the sun and deduces that it must be around 4 or 5 o'clock, she thinks. Best to be packing up the maters and melons and start heading on down the road. Need to get Matt his dinner. I hope he eats something today. He has not got enough down him to fill a sparrow in over a week. Sarah's head jots up towards the sound that was just barely audible. Even so, it was easy for her to know that it was the whine of an 18-wheeler on a tractor trailer just over the hill that blocked Sarah's sight. Thought Sarah. I bet by now that trucker's real dry in this heat. I bet he will want a cold melon to wet his whistle. Sarah thinks of the use that the extra 75 cents that one of the bigger melons could be put to, and she watched the truck grow in its approach at a high speed. Then at half the distance from the crest of the hill to the oak tree, the truck eases off the blacktop and onto the shoulder of the road. She thinks, good, I'll make this sell. But that damn fool better slow down some or he won't be able to stop. Sarah watches the truck as it arrows towards her closer with every passing second. Damn fool's asleep. Closer. You better put those air brakes on, boy. Closer. You're fixing to hit this here tree if you don't get back on the road, you idiot. Closer still. Sarah. She knows that voice. She should. But she has lived with it for the last 40 years. Sarah turns to the tree, blinks her eyes, and asks, Matt, how did you get way out here? Matt steps away from the tree and towards Sarah, holds out his hand and says, may I have this dance, Missy? Sarah takes the hand of the 18-year-old Matt. Brakes squeal, gravel is thrown every which way as a black Mercedes 420 slides to a stop. The driver jumps out of the car that now rests just to the side of the four-lane Interstate 287. The driver runs to the oak tree, stops, and does the PP dance as he scans the roads in both ways for the glare of headlights. There's none. So he unzips his pants and he fishes out his penis from its warm concealment with his left as he leans on the tree with his right hand. The driver begins to release the pressure which has been nagging at him for the last 30 miles onto the tree. He shivers, for the north wind on this cold October night has a real sting to it. The driver stands straight, listens for the sound of any approaching cars. There's none. With his right hand, he pulls up his collar to block the cold wind off his neck. He looks back at the bark of the tree, which appears to be black in the glow of his taillights from his Mercedes. All but one place. At that place, there's a long gash that is red in the glow of the taillights. The driver traces the horizontal wound with his unencumbered urine and thinks, something really big hit this tree. And hard. It was like a long time ago. Edges have grown over most of the gash. As the driver completes his business, he gives his penis two good shakes before returning to its warm abode. The driver runs back to his car, jumps in, almost catching his hand in the door as in his haste to regain the warmth of the car. He eases the Mercedes back onto the road and drives on, leaving only the faint gleam of his tarot lights on the venerable oak tree, the gash, and the two lovers dancing in the road on that warm summer night under the lone star. This next story may be self-explanatory. 1800 hours. I'm going to surrender to you something that has been kept in a dark place for many years. It may be an explanation of sleepless nights. It could be a story of life choices. It will not be, but it would be nice if this story was to unfold as if it was a pleasant tale of two best friends who endure the hardship of war and become all the closer for it. However, that would be a lie. And although a story need not be the truth, it should never be a lie. Time, 1800 hours, March the 30th, 1969. Place, a foot trail, 12 miles north by northwest of a nameless village in the South Vietnam, bordering on Cambodia. Two lone stragglers, refugees from a far fight, 3 miles, or 1 hour and 14 minutes, back down the trail, fight their way through the elephant grass, just to the right of the trail, snaking its way up into the high mountain valley. In the valley, the surviving members of the platoon have secured an LZ landing zone and now wait for a gunship to evacuate them from hell back to the relative peace of purgatory. The stragglers' trek is made all the more difficult by the tangles and uneven ground that must be traversed. The boys, for boys they were, had no desire to play Russian roulette with the trail, for surely it was laced with claymore mines, bouncing Betty's, punji stick, and a host of other equally distasteful booby traps. The two soldiers had been together from the start of their tour of duty. They were not friends, they were professional associates in the killing profession. Each knew the other would hold his section of the line and that his back would be safe. That and little more mattered. Keeping his head down, Sergeant Boot asked, "If it's March the 30th, 1969, in Clay County, back in the world, what time is it, Nam?" Private Jack looks up and replies, "Spring." "Spring? How can you tell?" Boot asks, and then adds, "But Nam had only two seasons. Wet hot and humid hot. Spring. Spring, spring, your promises grow. How cruel you are to me. I reached to pluck a rose. Instead, I'm plucked by a bee." Private Jack, back to scrutinizing the ground, observes, "The soldier poet. Now there's an oxymoron." "Nope, military intelligence is an oxymoron." Before the statement had time to clear his mouth, Sergeant Boot comes to a complete stop. Instinctively, the private stops, hunkers down, looks around in confusion. Sergeant Boot stands where he stopped, his eyes locked on something next to the trail. Slowly he starts, You know, the two things here that remind me the most about the world are the two things I detested the most there. Cal patties and, raising his hand to point at the object, prickly pear cactus. Now, who in the hell would have thought that you would find them here 12,000 miles away from home? But there it is. And on my first day here, I stepped off the tarmac, and it was right into a big, black, wet patty deposited a short time before by a water buffalo. Then as I backed up, dragging my foot, trying to get the crap off, I backed into a damn prickly. Huh. No one's welcome to hell could have been more appropriate. That assertion, the sergeant in the half-run kick with his left boot aimed well in the midpoint of the cactus. It is on occasions such as this that temporal edicts, if they exist, open up to new realities. Time misplaces its consistency. A span of time that should have been a fraction of a second becomes a moment, a minute, a lifetime. The action that followed lasted maybe 15 seconds, but for Private Jack it stretched out hopelessly, helplessly, endlessly, painfully, on and on. Under the influence of the new time, Private Jack watched as sergeant and disintegrated the cactus. But with the follow-through, a piece of wire hooks onto his boot and tugs at something on the other side of the trail. Sergeant Boot, in the midst of a perfect two-pointer, also starts to sense that something is not right. Straining back to a standing position, Private Jack's eyes follows the wire to the tree to the other side of the trail, where the wire disappears into the opening of a tin can attached to the tree with two rusty nails. Jack understands and does not at the same time. The wire, in new time speed, pulls the metallic ball free of the can, liberating its lever from the can wall restraint, sending it up to disappear in the glimmer of the setting sun. They both at the same time realize that the booby hand grenade trap is now armed and deadly. Sergeant Boot steps down on the trail with his left foot and almost instantly pounds down with his right to break into a run in an attempt to outdistance the Reaper. However, as he moves his left leg down the trail, the wire catapults the death ball between his legs out front and then back to wrap itself around his legs high into his crotch. The private saw the smoke, but truthfully could not say that he heard the explosion, only the ringing in his ear. He also had a taste in his mouth that reminded him of the pennies that he once carried there as he walked to the neighborhood store. What was he, 6, 7? No matter. He knew the taste of fear. Sergeant could not be seen from Jack's position. Slowly, the private steps towards the trail. And just as slowly, Boot's head, now without a helmet, lying face up on the trail, can be seen through the grass. Then more can be seen. The head is attached to the body, the eyes open to the sky. No movement. Is he dead? Private moves a little further up out of the grass, down to the trail. He stops and thinks, yeah. Yeah, he's dead. Thank God he is. No one should be alive with half of them blown away like that. Blood is filling the trail like a river of crushed berries. The private did not like to think about his next task. He had to get the dog tags from, that was for sure. Maybe the gunship could medevac the body out, maybe not. But the tags is a must. Stepping over the crimson stream, the private moves to the left of the body, where he can more easily get to the tags that he knows will be taped together, nestled between the sergeant and his shirt. One will stay with Boot, embedded deep in the gap between his top and bottom front teeth, jammed there by a hard uppercut administered by the private. The other Jack will take to the LZ. private eases down next to the body, not looking at the bloodless face. He reached into the shirt, feeling for the chain so that the tags could be fished out. Jack, Jack, can you see me, man? I'm half gone, man. Jack jumps, and like a crab, turned on its back, crawls stomach up, away from the talking corpse, kicking trail dust all over it as he retreats. The contents of the private's intestines turns into a red-hot liquid. Penny tastes his back, and his heart is attempting to rip itself out of its chest as he stammers, "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, Jack. This is not real. I'm messed up, but I don't feel any pain. I feel my legs, but they're gone. My butt's gone. Hell, little boot band's gone." Straining his eyes to see the now albino check, the sergeant adds, "The boot man is gone, but I still feel him standing at attention." The private slowly moves over to the sergeant, keeping his eyes locked on the other so that there will be no more surprises. He knows that a dead man, or one, that will be shortly, is talking to him. For no one can survive for long with that much of himself ripped away. Even if he did, who would choose to? He also knew that before the sergeant takes his last breath, he will be screaming his head off, for the pain will assert itself before death calls. Jack, this is one weird dream. Yeah, one hell of a weird dream, man. Dream, the sergeant grasps with hope. Must be. If this is not a dream, then I would be in a world of hurt. Just a dream, Boot. Just a dream. The private draws nearer to the sergeant, puts his left arm under his head and shoulder, and pulls the sergeant in close to him and repeats, "It's just a dream. Just a dream." "For real, Jack? Just a dream?" The sergeant looks into the private's face. With his eyes, he asks, hopefully, "Just a dream." The private assures, "It's just a dream. It can't be anything else." The private unsnaps the cover of his knife and frees it with his right hand. "No one can be fucked up like this and keep on talking except in the dream. It's just a dream." The private, using his right hand with the knife in it, pats the sergeant softly on the head. "It's only a dream, man." The sergeant closes his eyes and brings his left hand up, tightly holding onto the private's right arm. "It's only a dream." The private pulls the sergeant's head gently to his chest. "It's only a dream." The private places the knife at the base of the back of the sergeant's skull. "Just a dream." The blade finds home. The sergeant's left hand drops away from the private's arm. A dream. The private hears scrape, scrape, scrape. "It's only a dream." With a sinking feeling, he understands that the sound is the knife point scrape, scrape, scraping at the inside of the sergeant's skull. "It's only a dream." Instantly, like a bolt, Jack sits straight up in bed, sweat streaming from his every pore, pulls about him in a primordial sea. "It's only a dream." Jack eyes the darkness before him and hears scrape, scrape, scrape. "It's only a dream." He cuts his eyes up and to the right towards the window. Scrape, scrape, scrape. "It's only a dream." And sees the spectred hand of a branch of the oak tree outside of his window, scrape, scrape, scraping at the screen with every breath of wind created by the early spring night. Jack allows himself to lie back down, each vertebrae making contact with the cold, wet bed in succession. No need to look at the bedside clock. It's 2 a.m. in the world and 1800 hours in Vietnam. Jack stares at the moon shadows doing a slow dance on the ceiling over him and whispers, "It's only a dream. Only the same damn dream." Well, so much for Republicans and their wars, huh? This next story is it's kind of a little play with, you know, I work quite a bit with people with mental illnesses, and, you know, we tend to kind of make those go away, but then always think, well, what if, just what if these things that they see are not really a figment of their imagination? Ooh, that's something to keep you awake all night, isn't it? Time to go. It's Charlie Doc. Dr. Hill turns more fully towards Dr. Turner and continues. That's how it's, she started, and damned if she was not right. The young man sitting deep within his chair leans forward onto his toes with the heel of his shoe embedded in the cover at the base of the chair and demands, "You got to take Charlie away." Dr. Turner at first did not say a word. He just looked deeply into the frightened, pale blue eyes of his one-time student and full-time nemesis, and wonders why Hill would seek him out. One thing for sure, he was never liked by Hill. Nor did the young doctor Hill think much of Turner as a psychiatrist. So why is he here now? Hill has always been singular, even somewhat blighty. Nevertheless, Dr. Turner never entertained the notion that the young doctor would have, so soon out of internship, had a psychotic break. However, here is the pudding and thus the proof. "Go on," Dr. Turner nudged. Dr. Hill continued telling about how his patient presented her case. "It's Charlie, and he will not leave me alone. There's no getting away from him. Day and night, he's meaner, much more meaner than before." "That's what the patient told me. And when I asked who's Charlie, she informed me he is, well, was my husband, at least before. I don't know who, what he is now, not since I shot him."
"You shot your husband?"
"I told him I would if he didn't stop hurting me. I stopped him. He hasn't hit me from that day that I killed him till now. But what he's doing to me now is much worse. And he is not going to stop unless you take him away." "That is what she said. Somebody must take him away. Now you will take him away from me, won't you, Doc?" "I think we can," I assured her and then asked her, "But first, tell me more about Charlie. Do you hear him, see him? Does he tell you to hurt yourself or other people?" "Charlie lives in hell, and he takes me there." The patient stops for half a moment and then continues. "He does things there, things to others who are there. He makes me watch. I'm made to watch the terrible things he does to these poor souls. He is much crueler to them than he ever was to me. Why does he make me watch?" "So you feel unable to control things that Charlie does. Only Charlie controls Charlie. So, it's out of your hands. Is that what you're saying?" "That's what I said," snarled back my patient. "Well, James, what do you think she's meeting with her delusions?" Dr. Turner, in an attempt to play the game and to get to the heart of the young doctor's dilemma. "Charlie's not a fulfillment. He's a 2-ton albatross." "Yeah, to her it would feel that way, but we know this is a punishment, self-imposed retribution, 25 milligrams of Melaril, BID, and Charlie is gone. What will not leave will be the genesis of Charlie, and that is what you will need to help her with," Dr. Turner said, then leans back in his chair and he looks long at the doctor and asserts, "Neuroleptics have exorcised more demons and ghosts in their short history than all the chants and prayers and incantations
from the dawn of time. But the underlying problem will remain in your patient. There is no problem with my ex-patient. She's cured, so to speak, asserts Dr. Hill. Charlie won't haunt her ever again. If you're so sure of that, then why are you consulting with me on this case? Dr. Turner's question is cut short with, Charlie is now. Well, there's no other way to put it. He's hounding me now, day and night. Dr. Turner thinks to himself, now we're getting to it. Then he nestles further back into his chair. Five fingers of his left hand touch the tip of the five of his right. Dr. Hill continues, he's been with me for 3 weeks now. She made me promise that I would take him away. I told her I would. Give her a script. She took it, looked over to the corner of my office, smiled, laid the script on my desk, and stood up. Then she looked one more time around my office. What she saw or did not see pleased her. She walked out, and as she left, I could see that sanity begin to edge back into her face. Just like that, she walked away. I've not seen her since. If you haven't seen the patient, then how do you know? Once again, Dr. Hill cuts the older doctor off in mid-sentence. She's okay. It's over for her. I know, because after she walked out, I registered a small movement in the corner as she last checked. As I turned to look, the movement became a dark place, a shadow, a form, a Charlie. Dr. Hill stopped, looks down at the imitation Persian rug at his feet, and then adds, from that day to this, Charlie has been with me. So I know she's released. I took Charlie away from her, now he's with me. Dr. Turner focused all of his attention on the young doctor locked in the midst of a psychiatric break-in and inquires, where? Here, answered Hill. With me. Always with me. I can't get rid of him. You must. Please take him away from me. Turner focused his eyes more intensely on the young doctor. So you don't know whom the woman is? She just shows up, gives you Charlie, and then went on her merry way. Dr. Hill replies defensively, I know what you're thinking, that the young woman is a delusion, a hallucination that I conjured up to deal with some other kind of problem. But believe me, she is real and so is Charlie. But you can take him away, please, before he drags me back to that place where a lifetime of agony is spent with no passage of time. Do you know what makes hell hell? Time. Endless time. I think a person can endure almost any torture just as long as there is an end. But in hell, there is no end. Time flows in on itself without a start and without an end, on and on and on. When I'm there, I don't believe Charlie will ever bring me back. He has. But one of these trips will never end. He told me so. He will keep me. If you don't take him away, you must take him away, or he will keep me. You are going to take him away, will you not? You sad son of a bitch, Turner thinks to himself. And then, all of your training, your cocky attitude, you knew everything, had all the answers, always pushed me in class, leading others to question me. Now look at you, out of your fucking mind, and begging me to help you. Dr. Turner allowed a faint smile to play across the corner of his mouth, and in a phony, compassionate voice, said, of course I will help you. You will take Charlie away? Just slightly condescending, Dr. Turner assures, I'll take Charlie away. With this, the young doctor, in one complete release of muscle tension, collapsed to the back of his chair.
Dr. Turner pulls out of his desk a pre-printed prescription pad, scribbles Bill's name on it, along with an order for enough Melaril to guarantee that Charlie's haunting days will end, and that the good Dr. Hill will be limp and unable to play doctor for as long as he's taking the medication. Hill takes the script, looks at it, and smiles at the older doctor's choice of a panacea. Peering past Dr. Turner's left shoulder, Dr. Hill's face becomes bathed in fear and puzzlement, but is slowly lulled into a sea. He places the script down on the desk. In a learned ritual, Dr. Hill stands up, looks around the room, then without ceremony turns and walks out of the office into the cool October twilight. Dr. Turner picks up the script, scans it, and then looks back to the door, furrows his brows, puckers his lips, gives his head a slight side-to-side movement. Doctor? He froze, letting the prescription sheet slide from his hands back to the desk. Doctor? Turner feels his alum's apple drop to the pit of his stomach. Doctor? Turner keeps his eyes to the front, not bending towards the voice coming from his back and left of him. His heart is slamming into his chest in an increasing fast dance. With full force, the voice commands, Doctor! Turner makes an attempt at an unproductive swallow. Then, with full knowledge of the forthcoming reply, in a weak voice, a voice he asked, Is that you, Charlie? Yes, Doctor. What is it you want? Just come with me now. Why? I have something I would like for you to see. No. That's not one of your options. I may outline another option later, but for now, I have a special Halloween treat just for you. Get up. It's time to go. Well, little buckaroos, I hope you enjoyed my Halloween treat that I prepared for you. I hope you got something out of it. Well, we're going to close it down now. Don't forget, it's a listener-supported radio. Make your donations. Like I said, I'm heading off next weekend. I'm going to play the worst of Rick for you next week. But for now, relax, and let's get this world straightened out. I enjoyed reading my stories for you. I hope you enjoyed hearing them. Thank you so much, and see you around.
To Rick's Place. Sorry, Rangers. It is indeed closing time. Thanks for stopping by. See you all next week, where everyone comes to Rick's.
If it be your will that a voice be true from this broken
Now that'll be all. Be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.
And now, a breaking news update from Rick Goodner.
In relationship to the issues that we voted Mr. Obama into the presidency for, as of this hour, he is still irrelevant.
News from Rick's Place with Rick Goodner at Head On Radio Network, America's Liberal Voice. Tune in to Rick's Place at 7 p.m. on Saturday.
Something terrible is happening.
Something terrible is happening.
Something terrible is happening.
Something terrible is happening.
Health insurance executives are getting a bad rap.
As the healthcare debate heats up,
we need to remember who the real victims are.
Health insurance executives.
People are saying a lot of mean things about health insurance companies and their executives. And it's got to stop.
These great businessmen are American heroes.
So why is Obama trying to reform health care when insurance companies are doing just fine, making billions of dollars of profit?
Obama, why?
Insurance companies need our support because they keep our selfish priorities in check when we can't.
Please, doctor, my daughter's dying. She needs medication.
Think about somebody else for once.
If my kid falls off his bike and breaks his leg, he should have to pay that money out of pocket, out of his allowance.
How else is he going to learn not to fall off that bike?
And insurance companies are detail-oriented enough to deny claims for things like typos. If you spell something wrong, do you really deserve surgery? I don't think so.
80% of the American public support the public plan because it would give quality care people can actually afford.
But when you think about it, who's really supporting it other than 80% of the American people?
And the public option would make insurance companies lower their prices and give better service in order to compete.
What's so American about competition?
But health insurance companies are huge.
They need to make big profits so they can afford to give their employees health insurance.
Believe me, that stuff's not cheap.
It makes sense.
Insurance company CEOs have a right to their American dream.
And it's five houses.
A private plane.
$500 million in your pocket.
And a mini zoo in your backyard for exotic animals like a white tiger and pygmy horses.
Insurance companies offer you variety.
They can change the price and terms of your plan at any time or stop covering you altogether.
Do you want to get rid of those options?
So join us in the fight to protect our insurance company profits. They've looked out for our best interests for so long.
Now we should look out for theirs.
And I'm not being sarcastic, not at all.
MoveOn.org political action is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
Republicans want to end Medicare. You heard right. Republicans actually voted to abolish Medicare for future generations, one of the most important programs for seniors. America's seniors have relied on Medicare for over 40 years, and Democrats are working to strengthen Medicare. But the plain truth is, Republicans have opposed Medicare from the start. Their leaders have called for cutting Medicare, and now for killing it. The Republican Party, no friend of seniors. The Democratic National Committee is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. It's time for the Rick Smith Show. The phone lines are open. Call Rick at 1-877-960-0960 or email rick@thericksmithshow.com. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
Hey!
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here today on the big program. Dr. James Thomas, medical doctor, born in India, trained in Britain. He's going to be here talking about his experience with the British and American healthcare systems
as well as his reasons. And this is an interesting story, the reason he was brought to this country back in 1993. I think I want to focus on that a little bit with him as well, because if you go back to 93, when Bill and Hillary were trying to pass health care reform in this country, the HMOs really did a good job of springing up and fighting back any type of reform, because they knew there's a lot of money to be made in this. Big profits. And Dr. Thomas was, you know, according to him, and we're going to have that conversation, was brought here for what he thought was to help transition towards a social system, a system for everybody. And what actually turned out to be is his information was used to bring the system down. So that'll be an interesting conversation. And in the second hour, we're going to talk about climate change. We're going to talk about what the state of Pennsylvania is doing. Jan Jarrett, president and CEO of Penn Future, she'll be here to talk about that and talk about what the state's doing to move towards doing its part in the climate change fight. And also Sandy Christensen from Organizing for America. She's the leader of a local Organizing for America group talking about health care. So that ought to be an interesting conversation as well. But I got to tell you, Jake, I'm still, and I know we talked about this a bit yesterday, I am still on the brink of a major freaking psychotic meltdown. I am still fuming about the fact that, and I told you yesterday, I got a letter in the mail from the Department of Transportation. And you know I drive a truck for a living, so I have to have a commercial driver's license with a hazardous materials endorsement. So the Department of Transportation tells me, you know, Mr. Smith, your license is due to expire in May of 2010. Here is your terror risk assessment form. Please fill this out so that we can verify that you are not a criminal, you are not a terrorist. Oh, and by the way, once you finish filling this form out, take it to your nearest state police barracks and submit yourself for fingerprinting. So, you know, here again, I just did this 4 years ago. I've submitted myself. I've degraded myself, gone down there like a common criminal, and allowed myself to be fingerprinted. I filled out the terror risk assessment just so I can prove that I'm not a terrorist. And for that privilege, I get to pay a $60 fee on top of all that. And again, you know, this is where I can reach out to some conservatives who do fear government. And look, I've talked about this in the past, and I just had to get this out because I'm still fuming about it. I'm a supporter of government action. I'm a supporter of government of for and by we the people. But there are instances, and this is one of them, where our government has overstepped its bounds. And when Bush did this 7 years ago, I was against it then. And I'm even more against it now. And they're still talking about reauthorizing the Patriot Act. There are more discussions going on. And I'll tell you right now, if Obama allows this to be reauthorized, which I'm sure he probably will, I will consider it a failure of his administration. Because this is not the America that we should be fighting for, where you have to line up to be fingerprinted, line up to have your DNA taken. And listen, folks, if you think it's just a handful of truck drivers, you're next. I don't know if you've read the Real ID Act. That stuff is still in the pipeline. That stuff is still coming down. They are still going to have a national driver's license, whether we like it or not. And you're going to have to be fingerprinted, and you're going to have DNA collected. And I'm telling you, right now is the time you fight this stuff back. And this is where I can reach out to the people on the other side of the aisle, the conservatives, and say, look, this is where we have some common ground.
If I remember correctly, and I know I'm correct on this, Sam Rohr, we've had him on this show. Oh, by the way, he's running for governor. Did you know that? Probably yeah, didn't. Anyway, here's another point. The same people, and here's where it gets political, and I know that some people are going to say, oh, there you go again. Well, you know, the same conservatives who say government has too much power, guess what? These Mexican truck drivers that are going to be coming into our country in massive numbers in the not-too-distant future, are they going to have the same standards? Are they going to have to go through what you go through? I don't think so, because, oops, we gave up our sovereignty. And that's another issue where you have a absolute legitimate complaint.
Well, again, this is another one of those roadblocks. And we've talked about, when we talked to Paul Todd last week about the freight brokers and them basically just starving truck drivers, these independents. And I feel sorry for these poor guys. You know, they're busting their behinds and you know, sweatshop on wheels is an accurate t- title of what's going on. But these guys are working their behinds off for minimum wage, and less in some instances. And what it's set to do, and this is, you know, part of a bigger plan to just to get people, Americans, to get away from it so we can make the trucking industry like the farming industry, you know, like crop pickers. You're going to have these folks coming in from God knows where. And, you know, we've talked to people in the past who've said, look, they're building the I-69 corridor, the NAFTA superhighway, if you will. But they're building that toll road. And it's gonna right. You're going to see trucks coming right from Central America, right through the U.S. on up mm-hmm. into Canada, and the Canadians aren't happy about it either. But the reality is we're the first in that line. But I want to go back to this because I am still just my mind is just flipping out. And I had a conversation with somebody last night who said, "Well, what's the big deal? You know, we're just trying to keep the country safe. You know, we need to protect the country, and you drive around hazardous materials." And I go, you know what? Driving a truck doesn't take but a third grade education. There are two white lines, and you keep the wheel between them. That's pretty simple, I think. Doesn't take much more than that. And maybe to read a sign every once in a while. And this argument that, well, you know, if you're driving hazardous material, you could drive that into a building. Name one time where that has happened. It's not happened. And beyond that, if I'm a terrorist, do you really think I'm going to go through education, go through taking a test, go through certification, go through a terror risk assessment, just to get a little piece of paper that says I'm allowed to drive hazmat, and I'm going to drive that hazardous material into a building to kill myself? Do you really think I'm going to do that? Do you think this is a deterrent at all? Will this deter anyone from stealing a gas truck and driving into a building? No, of course not. Didn't stop anyone from flying a plane into a building. Did they have a pilot's license? Of course not. Because why would you go through the certification process? It makes no sense. No sense whatsoever. And I got to tell you, this just has me just flipping mad that we've allowed this to happen. And again, it goes back to the Patriot Act. And I'm telling you right now, we need to be calling our congressmen, we need to be calling our senators and saying, look, I don't want this reauthorized. Everything that the Patriot Act put into place, we already had. But there were procedures. There were safeguards to your liberties. The Patriot Act, all that did was streamline it, where we can do anything that we want to you at any time. And for me, that's what it's about. I'm as fearful of government as anyone else. But I want them to do things, and I want them to have protocol. If they're going to search my house, I want them to have a warrant. If they're going to get into my trunk of my car, they got to have probable cause. If they're going to take my fingerprints, I have got to be at least suspected of a crime. And that's what just has me just losing my mind today. Anyway, we're going to be talking with James Thompson, Thomas, medical doctor, Sandy Christensen, and also Jan Jarrett from Penn Futures. Your calls, 1-877-960-0960. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show. Issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Woke up one morning, I was feeling sick. Called up the doctor to see me quick. The voice on the phone said with no hesitation, if you've got insurance, you're our patient. I said, it's just a sore throat, I'll pay the bill. She said, well, it'll be $90 to look at your tonsils and $150 to establish you as a patient.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-877-960-0960. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, one of the things that I find interesting is China is talking about covering at least 90% of their citizens with basic health insurance. Now, remember, they've got 1.3 billion people, and they're talking about doing this within 3 years. They're talking about spending $120 billion almost immediately to put a new hospital or clinic in every one of their towns and villages. They're talking about training something like 3 to 5 million nurses in the next 3 years. And, you know, you look at this kind of policy, something that we don't really have in this country. We haven't really gone and said, you know, as a nation, this is what we want, this is what we need to do. We haven't had a Manhattan-type plan for quite some time. And right now is the first time that in a number of years that we've actually talked about how do we revamp our system? How do we make it better for consumers? How do we make people healthy again? But, you know, you got the people on the other side who are fighting this tooth and nail. And we hear all this fear and all this smear and all this, well, you don't want the Canadian system or you don't want the British system because that's socialized medicine. So I thought we need to talk to somebody who would have a perspective from both sides of the pond. That's why I've asked Dr. Thomas to come on the program. He is an Indian-born, British-trained physician. He lives here in the U.S. now. Dr. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm here.
I appreciate your taking time for me. Let me ask you this. Uh-huh. What do you see as the major strengths of each system and then, of course, the major weaknesses?
I think the major strength to start with the American system is that one can access investigations. The physicians can access investigations rather quickly purely because there is the equipment and knowledge and interest that goes along with that as far as the physicians are concerned to do it. As far as the British system is concerned, I don't think there is any system in the world today to beat their primary care health system because they are so well organized as far as primary care is concerned that there are no citizens in the United Kingdom that go without health care. And I presume since I worked from 1977 to 93 in the system and was very active, we had provisions for all issues, major issues that affected people's health in primary care. And this was totally funded by government actually taxing people a small amount depending upon what their wages were. And that allowed the people to come to a source of medicine where they did not have to pay at the point of service,
right,
which really helped the patients to come because they didn't have to worry about copays and any other sort of immediate financial problems that they would have to see a physician.
Well, that's an interesting point you make because one of the things we hear here, and I'm sure you've heard this, is that if we had a system like you're talking about where there are no point of service charges, there are no copays, that you would just have this mass flood of people to doctor's offices, and we would be overwhelmed.
I think that is untrue. One is the fact that the amount of patients that are allocated per physician is limited, so that the physicians can see these patients within the day. So if a patient wishes to see a physician on that day, they can actually see that physician on that same day that they request,
wow.
Or they can actually even get a house visit on the same day, and that is a 24-hour cover. So the amount of cases that actually turn up in emergency rooms are negligible. In fact, a vast majority of the cases, non-trauma cases that show up in the emergency room, are referred there by their primary care physicians who have actually physically seen these patients 24/7.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I talk about is my relationship that I have with my doctor. And I'm probably one of the luckiest guys I know that I have a very, very good relationship with my family doctor. He knows my kids. He knows my wife. We see him occasionally out in public. Hey, how you doing? How you feeling? That's the kind of relationship I think everybody needs to have with a physician.
I think that is extremely important, and I think that has been very well established in the British system. In that, I think every year around Christmas time, the London Times takes a poll and asks which profession do the people value the most and respect the most, and it's always, always been the physicians. There's never, ever been a time when the physicians have not been at the very top, usually number one. And the reason is that the patients, one is that they're not restricted to seeing that one physician. They can actually change the physician if they don't wish to see that same physician. All they have to do is take their insurance card and go to another physician and say, I'm, registering with you. And they don't have to give any reason. It could be the fact that they weren't treated appropriately, or the physician doesn't have good bedside manners, or the fact that they probably moved away from the area and they have a closer physician to them. So there's no restriction as to which physicians you should or shouldn't see, and there is no limits either. I mean, there's no limit saying, oh, just because you've changed a physician once, you can't do it for another 6 months or a year or whatever. It's entirely up to you, and you don't have to give any reasons for doing that. And the other thing is, no physicians can refuse a patient even if the patient has been allocated to them, because there are, as you know, patients who are problematic and they have difficulties with, various providers. But the National Health ensures that each one of those patients will have a physician. So everyone is covered every single day of their life from cradle to grave. There is no exceptions.
And in having that kind of a system, let me ask you this, as a physician in that system, where you know that cradle to grave, I mean, the system has got to take care of, got to make sure that you're well taken care of, that you get the medicine you need, you get the treatment you need. I think there's some incentive to keeping you well, to treating things like diabetes, for instance, which is a huge cost to the American system.
Yes, and actually it's amazing that if you look at the statistics, the amount of amputations, the amount of registered blind in this country, about 15% of the American population that register blind are because of poorly controlled diabetes mellitus. Now, in England, at the primary care level, we have diabetic healthcare nurses, and each practice is allocated healthcare nurse by the National Health who go out and visit our diabetics. In the entire period of time I was there, I don't recall one patient, and I had nearly 3,000 patients on my list, ever have to go for an amputation of any kind. They were very well controlled, and the ones that weren't were brought in, and we would discuss them at the clinic, encourage them, give them all the facilities they needed, including things like monitors and strips and educational material. Now, the problem here is that the majority of the diabetics usually are in the poor socioeconomic groups, and they cannot afford to have a diabetic testing strip. One strip costs a dollar in this country.
Yep.
Now, it is extremely difficult for somebody to monitor their blood sugars three or four times a day when a strip costs as much as that. So, I mean, the easy answer is don't monitor yourself, and that means you wind up in the emergency room with blood sugars running at 500 and 600 each time, and then, of course, the emergency room has to put these people on insulin drips and all those things, which costs a lot of money. And because of those issues, I mean, just for an example, just last week, I saw three patients in the emergency room, all three of them who had diabetic nephropathy, who were heading to dialysis. I mean, so these people are going to wind up with a far more expensive way of resolving their issue than the preventive care that would have helped them in the first place not to have, had to go into all these sort of problems. Another gentleman came in whose legs were completely numb from neuropathy, and he had fallen and wound up breaking his ribs and all sorts of stuff. And this guy wasn't, an old person. He was in his 60s. So here again you see the fact that preventative care has helped the National Health in Britain to do extremely well, whether it be asthma, whether it be hypertension, whether it be hyperlipidemia. Any of these conditions are so well monitored there, and we have got teams that work with these people. The other part is immunization. There is tremendous amount of encouragement to the parents to bring their children in, and if they don't, then we actually visit their homes and encourage their children to have immunizations. Now, for any reason, if the parent disagrees, there's no force. We don't beat them over the head to get immunized, but we encourage them and tell them that, these are the benefits, and there are some risks as well. So they make what is called an informed choice.
Yeah, that's a good thing. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Dr. James Thomas. He is an Indian-born, British-trained physician. Let me ask you this. Are you as disappointed in the current debate here in the U.S. Over health reform in that it doesn't really talk about the things we've been talking about really kind of changing our system to more of a preventative system from the reactionary system that we currently have? I mean, we used to know that, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Isn't that what Ben Franklin used to say? We used to know that. Why aren't we getting it now?
I think the important part is in American medicine is we have sort of focused on more treating disease than preventing disease. And that has been beneficial for certain, sectors of the industry, the insurance industry. For a fact, because what they do is they pick and choose who they want to be on their panels. They then decide who will not be covered. So they are picking the very healthiest to pay their premiums so they can make reasonably large profits. But the ones who are sick, count it out. And I can give you an example of myself. I mean, I was diagnosed with cancer a few years ago, and I promptly lost my insurance. The fact that when I was in Illinois, fortunately there was a CHIP program, whereas in Pennsylvania there is no such cover. So I have to pay a phenomenally large premium, something like $2,000 a month.
Wow.
To even get very basic cover, and those that coverage is even capped. The fact that if I had to get chemotherapy, God forbid, they capped me at about $1 million. That's it. If I cross that, and it's very easily passed, because I can just give you an example. The other day, I was suturing a patient's laceration, and I accidentally stuck myself with a needle. And because I did not have coverage at that point, I had to be tested for such an injury. I ended up paying $700 just to get lab tests done. Can you imagine just an ordinary person on the street having to pay that sort of money because they don't have insurance?
Man, I can't. So let me ask you this, because I think the obvious question is floating out there. If this is the case, and the British system is so great, why are you here? I mean, because I got to tell you, if it's me, I have cancer, I'm in this situation, I'm going back where I'm best suited.
You're absolutely right, and that has crossed my mind many, many, many times. And in fact, that is probably the reason, one of the reasons I've maintained dual citizenship, because tomorrow if something happened to me, and it's very possible that if I don't work, I don't get a wage, and if I don't get a wage, I can't pay my insurance premiums, and if I can't pay my insurance premiums, then I'm not covered. The only place I can go back to is Great Britain and get care, because I'm still a British citizen. Now, I don't think that is an option that Americans, I as an American, feel I should have to keep, just so that, the country I live in today and the place where I like should give me such a deal that I've got to make such a difficult choice.
Right.
There are many people who don't have that option. I mean, I've treated people who walked out of the emergency room saying, I'm better dead than alive to my family, because if I die, at least my term life policy will pay up, my family can survive. Now, that is a rather awful choice any human being has to make. And that is one of the things in Britain that allows the people to make, other choices, free choices. As far as employment is concerned, they're not restricted to staying with one employer. If they feel, they have got a better opportunity somewhere else, because they don't have to worry about health insurance. If they get unemployed, once again, I mean, they don't have to worry about paying premiums or whatever else. They, during the time they worked, they paid into the system, and the system helps them out right till the time that they get a job.
Yeah.
So all of this helps. Now, what is it the British system has been accused of in the past is the hospital system or the specialist system. Now, a lot of the times the specialists, it was difficult to get appointments with specialists. But, you needed a hip replacement, you had to wait a long time. Now, in 1988-89, Margaret Thatcher started a process called budget holding. Now, I was one of the people tasked in that plan to pioneer this whole program. And what we did was we said each physician's going to get X million dollars of budget each year, and they can spend it whichever way they want for their patients. So they can set aside X number of dollars for preventive care, X number of dollars for referrals for all their cases. Now, if a particular county did not offer them the service they required, they could go to another county and say, you know what, we've got X number of hernias to do. How soon can you do it? You know, we want a wait time of less than a week,
right.
You know, and this is X number of pounds we're going to pay for it. And so we completely eradicated our waiting list. Now, every system has a way of rationing. The only good part of the British system is you know what the rules are. Over here, you don't know what the rules are, because it's only when you go to find out, you know, whether it's covered or not, are you suddenly told it's not covered. You know, so you're left high and dry, and you're suddenly left with huge bills, which, you know, you're kind of worried how you're going to pay. So I would rather a system where I knew what the rules were right at the outset, so I knew exactly what to expect. And obviously, I also got the option by democratic means to change that if I required. Here, you don't have that, because you can't take a private insurance company, you know, and kick the CEO out because you don't like the policies they're putting out. They say, hey, you know, go somewhere else. But when a whole system is run by a few groups of people, it is impossible, because they make the rules.
Yep,
and
you're absolutely right.
You abide by those rules. And you abide by the rules, not even knowing what those rules are.
Yeah, we got about a minute left. I wanted to get one last question. And in 93, you said you came to the country. When we talked before, you came to the U.S. in what you thought was to help the HMOs move towards a British style system. If I have that right, can you talk real briefly about that and what came of that?
Yeah, I came on a sabbatical in 93 when Mrs. Clinton was putting forward the universal health care plan. And I think there were two phases, two sides to it. One was they wanted to understand the British system for one reason was, you know, if they had to cope with it, if the system was brought on in America. Number two is how could they sabotage it? And I was very surprised, because I actually came on a sabbatical from the National Health for that year, and I was very surprised. But when I spoke to a lot of the physicians involved, they really embraced the idea of the British system. It was only the administrators, the guys who are not physicians, who were looking at the dollar as the, you know, bottom line,
right,
who didn't think it was a very good idea. So I thought one of the things is, if I kind of stay back in this country and I can talk to people and encourage them to see the benefits that this country would reap. I mean, can you imagine that if all the companies in this country didn't have to worry about premiums because the system, the government would assist, you know, all its citizens to take care of their health issues, the companies would be free to compete on a global market with no restraints, because I believe the biggest cost they have is to insure their employees, and that is one of the big costs that would be off their backs, and they'd be playing on a level playing field with Europe and the other countries, like you said in your earlier talk about China. I mean, China's understood that if they keep their population healthy and working, then their companies can compete on a global market, you know, with a tremendous advantage.
Yep. Along with the tremendous advantage they already have. Last question before we wrap this up. What similarities are you seeing between 93 and today?
Well, once again, it is sadly, you know, I'm sure a lot of people have heard this through the media, is that for every representative or senator, there are six lobbyists. I mean, who's lobbying for the people? Apart from shows like this, who's lobbying for the people? 70 to 80% of the physicians in this country believe that there should be a public option. 70 to 80% of the physicians in this country,
yep,
believe there should be a public option. I haven't yet met a physician. I'm sure there's some out there who disagree. But not one physician have I spoken to, you know, whether it be in meetings or whatever, who said, oh, it's a really bad idea. Nobody. Because they feel they'll be removed from the constraints of looking at bottom lines and, you know, the dollar sign, and actually treating their patients like they should. Because now what you're looking at is, oh, how can I, you know, how can I make this thing worth my while to see this patient? Or should I see this patient at all? You know, because it's not worth my while seeing this patient because his insurance doesn't pay enough, or he's on Medicare or Medicaid or whatever else. That should never be something that a doctor has to choose when treating his patient. He should be treating the patient for the condition the patient comes in. Because each patient comes to his physician with only one thing, says, here's my life, I'm putting it in your hands, and I want you to take care of it. Now, if there is another reason why the physician is not going to take proper care of that, that should be removed, because I don't think any physician out there really wants that to be the reason that they don't treat their patients adequately. And I feel that the public should understand that and really plumb for a system whereby the continuing sort of relationship that patients have with physicians should be cemented and strengthened, not sort of, I mean, you hear in cases, oh, well, you know, he wouldn't treat me because my insurance wasn't appropriate, is something that I hope we never have to hear in the future.
Yeah, and we hear it all too often. Dr. James Thomas, I appreciate your taking time for us. Great points. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this.
1-877-960-0960. We shall overcharge. We shall overcharge. We shall overcharge.
Open. Give Rick a call at 1-877-960-0960. And now, back to the Rick Smith Show.
Yeah, I guess the question is when 86% of the people in a recent poll said that they want a single-payer healthcare system, or at least a strong public option, and they don't get it, you got to ask yourself why. Who benefits from this? You know, why aren't we the people getting what we the people obviously want when 86% say they want at least, at the minimum, a public option? It makes no sense to me.
Well, and then you listen to the doctor, and he gives you numbers on the percentages of doctors. I talked to this gentleman a couple weeks ago, and I was absolutely enthralled by the conversation I had with him for about 15, 20 minutes. And he touched on Margaret Thatcher. And for our listeners who are a little hazy on history, Margaret Thatcher is considered the great conservative in Great Britain in the 20th century. She's called the Iron Lady, considered very successful.
She was Ronald Reagan before Ronald Reagan was
correct.
Ronald Reagan.
And I was absolutely enthralled. This gentleman not only worked with her administration, he worked directly with her. And she was a very, very staunch advocate. Not only was she a staunch advocate, she did everything she could to improve the system because she understood the greater good. She understood that for Great Britain, even though some people might say, well, it goes against her conservative values, or at least what we understand as basic conservatism that avoids government, she embraced it because she knew it was very effective. And he worked hand in hand with her, and he was absolutely effusive with praise. Now, even me, and I would like to consider that I know a little bit about health care, I would have thought that she would have opposed it. And he said, absolutely not. She was a great champion, which really surprised me. And some of the other things about his system, he didn't give his system credit enough. He said, absolutely, he made the statement to me, that they are so effective on diabetes that it's very, very rare. And in some regions, it's almost unheard of because of what he said. They have a preventive system. They have classes. He actually said something else which just it dumbfounded me. He said, if they sign you up for one of these training sessions, you don't show up. Guess what? They knock on your door. They knock on your door and want to know why you didn't attend.
Well, you see that in the conservatives, Joe. Oh, it's the stormtroopers. The government's coming, going to make you go.
Well, it's like he said, and here's where those who oppose health care don't get it. If you have a preventive system, yes, it's initially to set up the infrastructure. It's going to cost money, but in the long run, for every dollar you invest, you're going to save multiple dollars within the healthcare system. Now, there's a unique concept, and that we don't even talk about that. It's always dollar value up front. And that's all that those who oppose healthcare emphasize. We can't afford it. Look at these numbers. Is that what you want? Well, yeah, it is what I want, because I know if we use this money to improve the healthcare system, for every dollar we put in, we're going to get multiple dollars back. And that's not even getting into the moral equivalency of this issue. It's simply right to provide health care for every American.
1-877-960-0960 if you've got a thought on this. Look, you know, the reality is the thing that I'm most disappointed about, I think, is we haven't really had that discussion about what our system should look like. And, you know, I got into it a little bit with the good doctor and said, look, you know, we haven't had the discussion on how do we move to a preventative system? How do we make sure that a 22-year-old girl, like the young lady in Oxford, Ohio, who gets sick, chooses not to go to the hospital, not to go to a doctor because she's uninsured, and she ends up dying from swine flu or H1N1 or whatever it is. When, quite frankly, she could have been cured early on. And what bothers me is you look at her case. For a $50 visit to the doctor that we didn't help her provide for, we paid for a helicopter to fly her to Toledo Hospital, from what I understand. That's about an $8,000 charge right there. You paid for all of the emergency people, all of the emergency room people, all of this stuff that you had to pay for when you could have solved it with possibly one early visit. It's mind-blowing. Let's take a quick call. We got Anthony on line one. How you doing today, Anthony?
Pretty good, sir. I just wanted to go ahead and say what you were saying just now. That's what gets me about these conservative talk show hosts. They're always saying how much poor people cost for health care because they don't go to the doctor. They don't go to the doctor. Like, they're trying to say it's their fault. My point is that, sure, some of those people, they know how sick they are. They know they should be going to the doctor, but their health care program is so bad that they can't afford to go.
Yep.
Until they're finally laying over on the floor, and they have to go, and then welfare or somebody, you know, some are going to end up paying a whole lot to take care of them because their system is really bad. And if we had something for them to just go to the doctor, could have said, well, Anthony, here's what's, God forbid, but you're here, what's wrong with you? Ever take these pills, stop doing this, and you'll be fine. That's if I can go early enough. But if I can't go early enough, well, then I still might have to get taken care of, but it's going to cost, excuse me, example, you have thousands of dollars a year and a whole bunch of other people until I get better or I, you know, something worse happens to me because I can't afford to go to the doctor.
Yeah, and even if you do fall out, your family's still going to have to pay those bills.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's insane about the system as well. There's no incentive to keep Anthony well. There's just not.
Well, if you keep me well, I ain't saying, oh, poor Anthony, take care of him, but if you keep me well, it won't cost you as much as it would if I ended up going completely on welfare because I have to quit my job and whatnot and whatever because my health gets worse.
That's exactly the point. And that's the conversation I don't think we've had, or at least a sufficient amount. I appreciate the call, Anthony. Thanks so much. You know, I'm looking at this Senate finance bill that just came out of committee. And, you know, now you've got all of these, you got five bills from what I understand. You got the Senate finance bill, you got the Senate health, education, labor, and pension bill, you've got the House education and labor bill, you have the House energy and commerce bill, and the House ways and means bill. And they've all had they're all out of committee, all except the Senate finance vote have voted on the legislation already. If I got this right. It's out of committee. Now we're in that markup period where Harry Reid and I think Chris Dodd and a couple people from the White House, we're going to go mash this thing together. And hopefully, you know, by the end of the month, we're going to have a vote on this. And I think it's important to know who voted against this in the Labor Committee or in the Finance Committee. Because only one Republican was on the side of the people, and that was Olympia Snow from Maine. The people who voted against it, Senator Grassley from Iowa, Senator Hatch, Senator Kyle from Arizona, Senator Bunning from Kentucky, Senator Crapo from Idaho, Senator Roberts from Kansas, Senator Einzang from Nevada, Senator Enzi from Wyoming, and Cornyn from Texas. All Republicans, all voted against the bill. And those are people who should you should remember their names, because they've been obstructing all along. This has taken as long as it's taken because of those people. So when you want to sit down and you want to go, well, why did the finance bill take so long? There you go. And I got to tell you, the industry, the healthcare industry, is really freaking out. I don't know if you saw this. The America's Health Insurance Plans lobby group, they're the big lobby group for the health insurance industry. They've really been working overtime to defeat this plan because it protects their profits. I mean, you got to be honest about what it is. Well, they commissioned this sham of a study. I don't know if you saw this, Jake, from PricewaterhouseCoopers to show that insurance reform would actually raise costs. And the conservatives went crazy this week. Oh, my gosh, we're going to pay $1,000 a piece more for this. One problem. And, you know, they did some serious fuzzy math here. They didn't bother to put anything in their study about cost savings. All they put in is what drives up the cost. And they write in their piece, the reform package under consideration have other provisions that we have not included in this analysis. We have not estimated the impact of the new subsidies on the net insurance cost to households. Also, if other provisions in healthcare reform are successful in lowering costs over the long term, those improvements would offset some of the impacts we have estimated. So basically, you know, they even admitted it on Tuesday. They said, well, you know, our study's a little bit misleading because, you know, we're bought and paid for. We're shills for the insurance industry. But, of course, that's nothing new. And you look at these groups that are out there that have just been well-funded, like Conservatives for Patients' Rights. They spent $20 million on radio and TV ads. And all they are is an arm of Americans for Prosperity. You know, the crazy right-wing group that's funded by multinational corporations and the Koch family. You may remember, they're the ones who hosted the Drill Baby Drill rallies, and they paid for Joe the unlicensed plumber to fight against the Employee Free Choice Act. On and on. You look at this other group, this Coalition to Protect Patients' Rights. I love these group names, these euphemistic names. They're beautiful. But what they're actually out to do is protect the profits of the big insurance companies. And the reality is we better figure out how to turn this around, Jake, because they're doing their job and they're doing it well.
I think they shot themselves in the foot, though, Rick, to be honest. I think Olympia Snow, that was a little bit of the reason, but these conservative Democrats, it angered them. It angered them because it gave a snapshot of what our healthcare system is going to be like if we allow, as we have now, a system controlled by them. I mean, to deliberately do that at a time when you have serious debate and to turn off people who tended to be on their side, I think that was a calculated mistake.
Yep.
And it backfired. And this is the other plus. Those Democrats who agreed with us on the House Finance Committee, even though it's a very mediocre bill, what they were voting for is not to say we changed our mind. What they're saying is we want the bill out.
Just get it out of committee.
Get it out of committee, then we can reform it.
Yep.
So I think it was a win-win for the proponents. Are we ultimately going to get it? I don't know. I sure hope so. Mm-hmm. And we need to call our senators and representatives. If you need to call every day for the next 2 weeks, do that. But the point is, there's some, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel, and there's some positive things happening here. And I think they shot themselves in the foot.
Well, I'm sure hoping that.
By the way, they forgot to tell the American people that with all these Gregonian provisions, we are going to raise. They forgot to say that. They acted like it was mandated by God. No, it was mandated by their parameters of what they need to make as far as profit. And, in fact, what they're doing is highlighting why we need to change the system. So I think it was a lose-lose on their part.
And good for them. Let's find out what John has to say about this. How you doing today, John?
Fine, thank you. That was one of the best guests you ever had on, and you have a lot of good ones. That doctor was very, very good, very enlightening. Just some of the things he said, he smashed a lot of the myths that are out there. you know, about the about a single payer system. Some of the myths that these right-wing conservatives promote all the time. And I don't want you to get the idea I spend a lot of time listening to Rush Limbaugh. I don't. Well, I'm in my automobile to and from work and so forth. I usually listen to your station because of the good music on it. But also, once in a while, if there's a commercial on or something, I'll turn over just to see what this guy has to say.
Yep.
And he was boasting again this week about the fact that he pays all his medical expenses right out of his own pocket. He doesn't even use his insurance company. He's not even sure what insurance he has.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Oh, my word. I mean, this guy is crazy. I mean, if he's that well-to-do that he can do that.
And he is.
Oh, yes. You would surely think that somebody like that, you know, would even remotely in the back reaches of his mind have an idea.